The final case for oral argument this morning is, of course, the County Board of Commissioners Appellant versus Curtis W. Hanks, Appellee. For the appellant is Mr. Thomas Simmons, an attorney from Rapid City, and at least making an appearance on the brief was Mr. Elton R. Anson, an attorney from Lemon. Madam Clerk, have you notified Mr. Anson of the time and place of this hearing?
Chief Justice Gilbertson, you have notified Mr. Anson.
And did, upon that notification, did he indicate whether he was attending or not?
On the first notification, he clarified that he would be attending. He called back later and said that he would be making his appearance at this hard point.
Very well. Mr. Simmons, under the court's prerogatives, it can proceed with just an appearance by the appellant, and that's what we intend to do today. We will give you the 20 minutes that you would ordinarily get for an opening. Since you have nothing to rebut, that would be the time that you would be allowed to be the 20 minutes. Do you understand that?
I understand.
Okay. Do you have any comments before you proceed?
No.
All right. You have the 20 minutes then.
May it please the court, and good morning on this beautiful, beautiful morning. I am Tom Simmons here on behalf of the appellant Corson County Board of County Commissioners. This is a matter that you'll recall you have heard before. The first time that you heard this matter, you were faced with a rather broad policy-making decision kind of a task that could have implications for counties across our state. This time, you're faced with a much more narrow legal analysis in terms of basically all the law being in the form of the prior decision, and a fairly narrow factual issue in terms of all the facts being within the 80 or so page transcript. The holding of this court the first time was that the 2003 legal services contract at issue was ambiguous, and this court held that boards of county commissioners do have the authority to contract privately for legal services for three areas: for criminal and civil cases with more than one lawyer in opposition, two, for representation in counties other than Corson County or in federal and tribal courts, and three, for legal advice and opinions to the board. The language of the contract itself says that the private attorney, Cheryl Bogue, or the Bogue & Bogue Law Firm, was to perform all civil representation regarding the county as may be requested in state, federal, and tribal courts as set forth in Chapter 716. It's undisputed that Cheryl Bogue did not appear in any criminal case on behalf of the county. It's undisputed that she did not appear on behalf of Corson County in any civil case, that there were, in fact, no civil cases pending in Corson County during the entire 2003 year other than this particular case during the first hearing.
Administrative proceedings. Did she appear in any administrative proceedings?
No. No. In fact, Cheryl Bogue's engagement by the county was more limited than what this court has said is permissible. What the county commissioners hired her for was her specialty and expertise in federal Indian law jurisdictional issues. Corson County itself is unique in that it is entirely within the boundaries of an Indian reservation. It therefore runs into a number of rather complex Indian law, federal jurisdictional issues. And that was the purpose for which Cheryl Bogue was hired. On the remand hearing, six witnesses were presented.
Backing up to that last statement, why did they not seek that kind of expertise from Mr. Hanks?
I believe that they probably could have. They believed that they were within their discretion to hire a private attorney for specialized advice and counsel on those matters. I don't know, but I don't think that Mr. Hanks could refuse to perform those duties if requested.
What's at stake here? If we affirm Circuit Court Judge Warren Johnson, will Cheryl Bogue be liable for 5 years of back pay of $125,000?
I think that's one possibility that hasn't been raised or asked for, but that's certainly one possible consequence, yes. There are, not before this court, but there are other cases that have been brought on successive contracts that were entered into.
As I understand it, though, this is an a county commissioner appeal involving just the 2003 contract.
That's correct. It's limited to the 2003 contract. That's correct. And the second issue that's out there is the eligibility of Mr. Hanks to serve in the role of state's attorney by virtue of the fact that he simultaneously holds a judicial post.
So if he is ineligible to be the state's attorney, then they can hire anybody they want to under the statute.
Or someone else could run, yes.
All right.
I think on that second issue, what the circuit judge erred in terms of the legal analysis, it's a de novo review on that particular issue, is that the circuit judge determined, one, that he didn't have any authority to actually remove Mr. Hanks. And that's a true and accurate conclusion, I think, that it could only be brought in terms of an actual removal within a quo warranto, that he could not actually be removed by the circuit judge. That's not, however, what this court directed the circuit judge to do. This court directed the circuit judge to determine the legal effects of the fact that he held a judicial office. What Mr. Hanks argued, and the second part of the court's legal error on that issue, is that he may be rendered ineligible to serve as a judge, but he's not rendered ineligible to serve as state's attorney. He put forth the legal interpretation of the statute that says no state's attorney may have any judicial office as rendering him ineligible to hold his judicial post, which is a tribal post that these courts obviously have no jurisdiction over, but that it doesn't affect his eligibility as state's attorney. I don't think that holds any water when you look at the fact that that prohibition on state's attorneys is found within Chapter 716, the state's attorney chapter. It is a directive that's directed specifically at state's attorneys.
It's not in the eligibility statute, though.
It is not within the eligibility statute. It's in a separate statute. That's correct, Justice Center.
Simply because the code council put it where the code council wanted to, right?
I would suppose so. I don't know why it is where it is, but it's there, and it's the law.
But you would concede that there is no authority from this court or any court in South Dakota as far as Mr. Hanks' right to hold that judicial office of the tribal court.
That's absolutely correct.
That's vested with the tribe.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct.
Is it a fact that Attorney Bogue drew this contract for the Board of County Commissioners based on a prior contract where an attorney was needed because there was no state's attorney?
Well, there was quite a bit of testimony on the history by which the actual contract form was obtained. I think ultimately, although that's somewhat helpful background, really doesn't affect the determination of what was the intent of the parties and the application of the contract. This court, the first time around, determined that the language there was ambiguous, that it couldn't determine whether the language itself would have displaced the state's attorney. It depended more upon what the parties did. And all of the evidence showed that Mr. Hanks was not displaced from his role as state's attorney, that all of the things that Cheryl Bogue did were related to advice and counsel, which are specifically permitted. And even narrower than that, they were restricted in almost all but two very limited circumstances to advice and counsel on federal Indian law jurisdictional questions that the board had.
But by the same token, if there is any ambiguity in the contract, which you've concluded or you recited that we found in the first case, that ambiguity would be construed against her as attorney for the board or against the board who's the scrivener of the contract?
That, I don't think that statute or that contractual interpretative rule applies because the person that raised that is not a party to the contract. Mr. Hanks raised that, and there are cases we cite in our reply brief that he, as a third party unrelated to this contract, can't rule the read it against the Scrivener rule.
So you think that rule does not apply?
That's correct.
Thank you.
With respect to the Indian issues, if Ms. Bogue was not involved in any cases, criminal, civil, or administrative, then the only way this contract could be valid would be under the opinion and advice exception. Is that, are we together on that?
Well, I believe that the only two things that could conceivably come outside the advice exception would be, maybe three things. One would be that the board intended that if there was a federal case that came up,
sure,
or a case outside the county, that for her retainer, flat fee, she would be required to represent the county. That didn't happen to come up, but it was the intent of the parties.
But there wasn't evidence on that in the record, was there?
There was no civil case outside the county during this year.
Or, I don't recall evidence that that they intended this to apply as an advanced retainer for any federal litigation or Indian litigation that may occur in tribal or federal court.
I believe that's fair in the sense that the primary function for which they hired her was not for her trial attorney expertise, but for her advice expertise. But Cheryl Bogue understood that if a case arose outside of the county, that she would be required to defend that on behalf of the county for her retainer. That's within her testimony.
So how should we view this case? Should we view it as a contract that was or was not intended to litigate tribal and federal matters?
I believe she intended it to include those matters if they arose.
And she testified to that?
Yes, that she would be required to perform in other courts.
What are you asking this court to do this time around?
Justice Meyer-Henry, we're asking for the court to reverse the circuit judge's decision that the contract is void. There is not evidence to support the conclusion that Mr. Hanks was displaced. And we're asking for a determination that Mr. Hanks may not serve in those two roles at the same time. Any actual removal, again, would be conducted separately. The basis, I think, for the circuit judge's decision in terms of finding that the contract is void is based erroneously upon looking back at the contract language again. You'll see a lot of information and testimony, questions from the judge on the transcript that relate to the broad nature of the contract. And this court's already determined that's not helpful in reaching this decision.
If we determine in this case, though, that Mr. Hanks is not legally holding office, would that be a res judicata effect against him if somebody seeks to remove it, since he is a party to this action?
It would, I believe, unless the circumstances change. If, for example, he resigns or is terminated from his post as a judge, I don't think that he could then be removed. I think that would depend upon the circumstances in existence at the time. And that may well be the case, and it may well be the case that the county commissioners don't bring a quo warranto proceeding. But the issue is now that we're concerned about the res judicata effect on the other side of the coin, that he is eligible to serve those two roles. And we don't believe that to be the case.
Well, explain that you're conceding quo warranto is the proper method.
Yes.
Determine entitlement to all of the office of state's attorney.
Yes.
If you concede that, then tell me again how you get to the next step of where the judge went wrong and saying, look, in this proceeding to challenge the contract.
I think there's two parts to the judge's decision on that. And one is he doesn't say quo warranto, but I believe that's what he means. But the other part is that statute doesn't apply to Mr. Hanks because he holds a tribal office. And this court can't remove him from his tribal office, therefore he's not in violation of that statute. And that's erroneous. That's incorrect. He is ineligible to serve as a judge while he serves as state's attorney.
So what you're asking for then is a declaration that he's violating the statute. No more, no less? Is that what you're
asking? Right. That's right. That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
You're not challenging his office.
We are not, and we can't within this.
You're not defending the contract based on the violation. You simply want a declaration of a violation, as we had mentioned in our last opinion.
Yes.
Okay.
So following up on an earlier question of Justice Zinner's, you do see this as a qualification issue?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So if we rule in your favor on the contract question, what impact, I think I'm following up on Justice Saber's earlier question, what is the impact of that, if we don't, I guess?
Let me re-ask the question, Justice Meyer-Henry. If this court finds that the contract itself is not void, what is the effect of that? I think it has the effect of removing any other potential remedies that would follow from that, such as whether Cheryl Bogue's payment needs to be returned, and it would have an effect on the other pending cases before the circuit judge on the other contracts. Now, those are not properly before this court, I
assume, but. Judge Johnson considered that. Was that raised as to the implications of a ruling such that he entered here?
I think so. I think the circuit judge determined and decided incorrectly that, one, the contract could be used to determine whether the contract itself was too broad, which is incorrect, and two, relied on the fact that Mr. Hanks didn't come to all the meetings. Now, there's one disputed fact in terms of the state's attorney attendance at the county commissioner meetings. Mr. Hanks says that he was never specifically invited to attend. The commissioners testified, and Cheryl Bogue testified, that he was. So that's in dispute. But it's not in dispute that he was never barred from attending. He was never asked not to attend. In fact, he indicated repeatedly, I'll be in my office during your meetings. Call me if you need me. And that was the way these meetings and Mr. Hanks operated. He was never excluded from a meeting, and there's no evidence of any kind that would suggest that. So we don't feel that that in itself, and that's what the circuit judge relied on, is evidence that the contract itself exceeds the parameters by which county commissioners can hire counsel. The only two...
Let me ask you about this guy. The void contract again. Judge Johnson's conclusions of law say that it's void to the extent that it exceeds the three permissible areas. And it seems to me like that both sides should probably, or at least logically, I would think both sides would probably agree if the law is you can't exceed these three areas. And if Judge Johnson's conclusion of law is it's only void to the extent it exceeds these three areas, then what's the problem?
Well, I think it's a non-decision in terms of the findings and the conclusions, because it just repeats what this court said. To the extent it exceeds those parameters, it is void. But he was asked to determine whether it is or void, in whole or in part. His judgment, though, goes further and says that the contract is void. It takes that a step further than the actual conclusion of law.
Completely.
Yes.
Well, you didn't brief this issue, but, and it's kind of interesting, what is the significance then of if the judgment and the conclusions of law are at odds?
I don't know if they're necessarily at odds. I think the judgment just clarifies that he has determined that, in fact, it is completely void.
But how do we know that? I mean, his conclusions of law clearly say to the extent.
Yes, they do. I don't know if I have an answer for you. I think the judgment would ultimately prevail, and I think you can read both of those together to ascertain what the judge has ultimately done.
Well, your client would prefer a partially void contract rather than a completely void contract, wouldn't
you? I would say yes, but I don't think there's any evidence to support even a partial invalidity. I really don't, because the parties acted in such a manner that they complied with those parameters. The only two...
So let me just interrupt you. So what you would prefer that the judgment say is that the legal services contract is not void, or whatever other term you want to use, because it because it only requires performance in these three areas.
Yes.
That's what you want changed.
And specifically on remand, the circuit judge was directed to examine the intent of the parties and the application of the contract. And the testimony shows that she was hired for specialty areas, not specifically reserved for the state's attorney, and that that's the way the contract was performed, other than a siding issue. A siding issue was an issue that the county courthouse, which has since burned down, had inadequate siding. Cheryl Bowe gave them some advice on that. That's outside of her specialty, but it doesn't violate the parameters because it's advice to the council. And at any rate, that was ultimately turned over to Mr. Hanks. The only other issue that falls outside that general description of Indian law specialties is she apparently signed some sort of federal foreclosure stipulation that was then re-signed by Mr. Hanks. It was a federal issue. At any rate, it wasn't an issue within the county. And those are the only two specific issues that they have raised in terms of potential displacement.
I thought there were some issues about her actually representing the county on the dispute over the siting with the third party, as well as some land issues and some Indian health issues, where she apparently was going out and talking with Indian Health Service or somebody else on behalf of the county. Is that,
yes,
is that accurate?
She would have dealt with, on the, as I understand it, on the Indian Health Service medical indigent claim denial issues that the county faced. She would prepare a letter to the, generally to Yankton, I believe, or a county hospital, in which a Corson County resident and tribal member had received services and had a way in which to indicate that those should not be paid so that the county didn't have to reimburse for those expenses. I don't think, though, that that's excluded under the decision. She is communicating, first of all, it's for matters outside of the county, and she's been retained to handle those specialty areas. It's not appearing in any court, certainly.
Other questions from the bench? I guess the time is technically expired, but we're not terribly rushed here. Anybody got anything else? If not, thank you for coming. And
thank you.
I guess the court is in recess.